so this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Master Corporal Jaden Cormier, recorded on March 8th, 2016 at the Bay Street Armory in Victoria, interviewed by Josie Gray. So, Master Corporal Cormier, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
And could you state your full name for the
record? My name is Master Corporal Jaden Keith Simpson Cormier.
Okay, thank you. So, when did you join the Canadian Armed Forces, and what motivated that decision?
I joined the Canadian Forces as a reservist in December 10th, 2005. And the big motivator for that was, while I was in high school, I was looking for another means to be more active outside of the smaller community which I was. So the closest thing that was in the area was Nanaimo, and out of that for the military was the primary reserves, the King and Scottish. We had an interview with a recruiter that came to our school, and me and another friend at the time decided that that would be kind of something that would fulfill that role, so mm-hmm. shortly after that we moved.
Right. And you were 16 at the time?
That is correct.
Right. Right. Okay. Why did you volunteer to go to Afghanistan?
After doing my basic training and my qualification courses for the infantry, the opportunity came up. It wasn't originally something that I gave much thought to, but it was presented to me upon asking a few questions on what that would entail. I was told that there were opportunities within the provincial reconstruction team, which deals mostly with humanitarian workers and civil aids. At the time, I was involved in a humanitarian group that went to Mexico quite frequently, and so being able to coincide my passion for humanitarian aid with my passion for the military was something that really sparked my interest.
Right, right. So did you receive specific training for your deployment?
Yes. So as a reservist, 20% of missions and operations, external operations, are fulfilled or filled by reservists. So in order to become up to par for whatever the mission-specific training, we go on something called workup training. So from April of 2007 until February of 2008, I was in Edmonton working alongside my Red Force counterparts to get ready for the upcoming mission, which occurred in February 2008.
Right. So was there, like, specific, like, what kind of training did you have to do?
We were brought to Edmonton under our task force, and from there we were assembled into our groups. As I said, I belonged to the provincial reconstruction team, so I was placed with one PPCLI, who was the force protection company for the provincial reconstruction team. My training started originally mostly driver-oriented, because just how the logistics happened at the time, I was one of the few people that currently had one of the qualifications, having recently done my driver's qualification before going to Edmonton. So I started off doing driver-specific training, but the vehicle that I was trained on wasn't actually going to be the vehicle that I was using overseas, so I switched back over to just being a dismounted rifleman within an infantry company. Specific training included foreign weapons, dismounted platoon attacks, mounted in convoy operations, how to deal with close protection of either humanitarians or civil aid workers or government workers, local cultural training, that kind of stuff. Generic overall, but specific to the operation of Afghanistan.
Right, right. Could you maybe give me some descriptions of like cultural or training?
We were given unclassified briefs on both from individuals who studied Afghan culture, but also locals and interpreters that were either brought over or volunteered their time. Religious aspects, culture aspects on how a good example is shaking hands in close proximity. Afghan culture, it's very common to hold a hand for a duration of the conversation and pull the person slightly towards you, so something in our culture that might not necessarily be deemed as a common occurrence, that's very common there. So just being prepared for things like that when dealing with locals. is a good example. Basic language training, how to get somebody to stop or move or get their attention or ask them to move off to the side or whatever burial things that we need to occur.
Right. So can you describe actually arriving in Kandahar and your initial impressions in
a few days? So I arrived at night. I remember that's the first thing I do remember. I arrived on a CF-130 Hercules, which is a large transport aircraft. We landed in Kandahar Airfield, where we were shuttled off, I remember. Shuttled off the tarmac, and then, similar to many military, whether it's an exercise or an operation, you do something called an RSOM, which is a rearward staging onward movement. You're brought in, your paperwork's dealt with, you're cleared in, you receive your mission-specific equipment, your mission-specific orientation. And then that was all done in a fluster of about 6 hours, and then we were placed in transient quarters for the evening to adjust. I remember waking up in the morning in Kandahar Airfield, where we then were given a final brief and a road movement brief. And later that day, I was placed on a convoy and moved out to Camp Nathan Smith, which was where the provincial reconstruction team is. So it was a whirlwind, especially for somebody. As I said, at the time of my deployment, I was 18. So I was relatively young in comparison to a lot of people.
Right.
So just taking everything in. It was nice coming in at night because it was cooler.
Mm-hmm.
So next morning was pretty hot.
Okay. So were you based mostly out of Camp Nathan Smith? Is that
That's correct. Yeah. I would do so our main camp was Nathan Smith. We would do rotations to the forward operating bases throughout the province itself, and along one of our duties was rotated from our section, so there's four sections. 1 week stints at the palace downtown Kandahar to assist with the protection and training of the security for the palace and the president.
So it was pretty quick that you got down and were kind of put right to work?
Yes. So I remember, I remember this actually. I was cleared in, so that road movement was the next day. So I probably got, it's not too far of a trip from Kandahar to Camp Nathan Smith. It's a couple hours of that if you're moving slow and taking alternate routes and stopping appropriately. I remember getting in, and I remember the first thing is you see the company sergeant go into the office, grab any other specific equipment from the company quartermaster, and then I was shoved to my shack. I shared a room, small, not a very large room with the other 12 members of my section. I remember actually I was left alone for about an hour and I didn't know if I was supposed to be or not. It was pretty funny. And then eventually I found my section commander. They were out on a patrol that day, which is why. So how it works is not everyone, it's not just a big chunk. Everyone all moves together. Everyone's rotated in. So they rotate a couple people at a time every couple days. So a bit more people will come and so forth and so forth. And as that's happening, the last rotation is doing the same thing, moving people up. So my section commander and a couple of my section mates were already on the ground prior to me even being there.
Right.
And so having to find them, and they were running at half capacity, so amalgamating two sections together to operate a vehicle for a convoy until everyone's on the ground. The first thing that happened for individuals at the camp is they would do defense and security. It's a good way to orient them to the camp, the surrounding area, and just get used to the temperature. So, very first day, by the end of I believe it was the first day, many years ago, you just do like an eight-hour tower shift, just to basically basically sit and get adjusted to the temperature. Do that for a couple of days, and you would start your first patrol packet, depending on when your section was designated to start patrol.
Right. So was there, like, significant, like, with, like, people coming in and people coming out, was there, like, certain kind of, like, orientation that you went through with the people that had been there with the previous deployment?
Yes. So for my level, you know, as a private, it was rather low-key. Mm-hmm. But for section commander and beyond, platoon commanders, company commanders, quartermasters, very particular handovers for different positions, and they would talk. The funny part was we replaced the Van Deus, which is our French, primarily French-speaking regiment. So in order to get all three parties to talk, you would need a translator for Pashto or Farsi, a translator for English to French, and back and forth. So you would have to translate three different times if you wanted to get one message from one party through the second party to the third party, mm-hmm. which was a rather funny occurrence. But as far as handovers go, for myself, it was nice for me because it came right from my section commander. I wasn't one of the first individuals on the ground, so I didn't have to deal with receiving something from someone I never met. There's already somebody I'd spent the last 10 months with and was comfortable with.
So. Right. So could you describe your position on the ground?
Sure. So the Provincial Reconstruction Team, as I said, they primarily dealt with humanitarian workers, government officials, any infrastructure reconstruction projects that occurred within the area of operation, which was Canada. And within that team, there is the Force Protection Company. And so the Force Protection Company is designed not only for quick reaction to any incident that happens within the area, but is also there to provide protection for individuals who are focusing on other things, focusing on the infrastructure, focusing on the governance and the rehabilitation of humanitarian aid. So we would roll out to various areas of interest. A good example would be schools for third-party engineer groups that want to help rebuild school infrastructures, or Afghan National Police buildings and the Afghan National Army's facilities as well, rehabilitating and reconstructing the infrastructure there. And so it was really mostly just convoy movements and dismounted patrolling within the city itself when we were attached to the palace. It was a very interesting job. It was a really rewarding job. You get to see the, mm-hmm. the rehabilitated side, the reconstruction side of it, which was nice.
So, like, what kind of equipment and weapons were you working with?
So I was a rifleman. So I used the C-782 service rifle alongside the C-79 A2 optical sight. That was my standard issue. I was also a breacher. So I had the Remington 870 12-gauge shotgun. Two times battle load, so 600 rounds of ammunition, a 5.56 for that. Two HE frag grenades, two smoke. I carry several 40-round millimeters for the M203 for my section mates. An extra box of 5.56 linked for the C9. And, variety of small arms. In addition to that, I was in what is known as an RG-31 Nyala. It's an armored fighting vehicle at the Bolt Hall. You may have seen it. It's not the lab is the typical green.
Yeah.
Have you seen the orange or the tan boxier vehicle?
Yeah.
That's an RG-31 Nyala.
Right.
And so its weapon mount system is a C6 general purpose machine gun of 7.62 millimeter.
Thanks. And I guess it's kind of, I submit my questions to my prof and he kind of gives me suggestions. So he was suggesting asking about the equipment and kind of like if it worked well and if it was like adequate for what you needed. And
I like the RG. The RG is a far smoother ride. It's also a safer ride in comparison. I was very fortunate not to have any ID incidents. But the boat ship hull is designed to blast off the vehicle will be immobilized for sure, but it's a lot safer. It disperses the explosion.
Right.
I didn't have any issue with this. It just mattered. So we took, mm-hmm. There's a lot of maintenance that went into the vehicles for sure. You would spend, the day wasn't over. If you're out for 16 hours, it doesn't, you would get back to the camp and turn the key off and the day's over to the next one. You spend a couple hours beforehand and a couple hours afterwards making sure everything's good to go for the next day.
Right.
It's kind of nice too because it was a built camaraderie in a more mm-hmm. eased setting. Sit down with your fellow section mates, clean a vehicle.
Mm-hmm. So, to what extent did you have to work with civilian development officers? And like, were you mostly just providing security, or were you assisting them?
Yes. So for myself, it was a lot of indirect. I was with them the majority of the time when we weren't cycled either to the palace or to forward operating bases. But when we were actually doing our patrols within the city and in the area of operation, we would always have, in our vehicles, they would disperse them, right? So we'd have two or three, either an engineer or a humanitarian aid worker or a government official that we'd be moving to whatever location. So we would, you'd sit and chat with them within the vehicle, but on the ground, we were outwards focused. Mm-hmm. That was our job. We were, occasionally we'd be called over to assist with something or move something or something, but our job was majority was to provide a coordinate around wherever they were working.
Mm-hmm. And were there lots of incidents where that was necessary?
That was the majority of the day.
Like where you actually either were attacked or...
Are you referring, or are there many incidents where we were attacked or engaged?
Yeah.
Outside of, so there was this common one is the Syracuse prison outbreak
mm-hmm.
that happened in 2008. So that was probably the biggest incident that occurred alongside the push afterwards, the 3-day push. And then outside, we had in February 17th, we responded to a suicide bombing at a dogfight. Another incident. So, as I said, one of the secondary duties of the provincial recharge team is everyone has to be self-reliant, so quick reaction force was in place.
Mm-hmm.
And you rotate through that. Most of that's responsive. So, most common thing would be dealing with an IED that went off in the area, either with one of our vehicles or another out mission element that's moving through our area of operation.
So, did you ever work with the Afghan National Army or the Afghan National Police?
Yes, I worked with the Afghan National Police probably every second or third day. Both there's camp security, there's FOB security, and then on FOB, when we were pushed out to a forward operating basis, they're, for lack of a better word, there are pathfinders and our engagement between the link between. The people, we use them a lot. So dealing with the Afghan National Police Force was a regular occurrence. Once again, being the lower guy on the pole, I'd be less directive or policy making and more just
mm-hmm.
listening to the intent of what my section commander wanted and
right.
assisting with that. There's another agency called the Blue Hackle. They're a private security company that is hired by the palace. And so when we would go to the palace to work with them as well, they're mostly East Indian-based person.
Mm-hmm.
So work with them on a daily basis as well.
Right. So was there was there any difficulties working with?
Cultural things. Any male or female, for that matter, people will tend to try to measure up to one another, and they want to see who they're working with. So usually, for the most part, everyone was very professional, but sometimes you get humble from somebody who wants to flex their muscle.
Right.
As long as mm-hmm. not a responder. It's perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. They'll realize that you're not you're above trying to measure who's the tougher person, and you really just want to get your job done. Mm-hmm.
What about in like just practices, like or policy, like in.
So culturally, the acting culture is slower when it comes to moving on with the plan or developing a plan and executing it. You can talk for days and hours about something, where in Western culture we're a little bit more quick to draw, like, okay, here's the factors, here's our courses of action, this is the best one based on what we've just talked about, let's go do it. In Afghan culture, you wouldn't even start discussing, even start moving towards discussing factors until you me and you have just had a conversation. You know, how many siblings do you have? Where are you from? What's your family? Like, where's your brother from? Where does your brother live? Who's his family? Then it's a lot more. And then and that part I actually really enjoy. I think that there are merits to getting to know somebody before you even start discussing a plan or an operation. But for some people, that can be frustrating. Your time's ticking, and you have so much time to get something done. Mm-hmm. So that's very, very different. As I said, little cultural things, which hand to use to shake with, holding hands and talking close to one another, the proximity, how loud you talk. Typically, Afghans speak quieter. And we're often seen as being a bit more loud out there and throwing your voice. So it's just a lot of little cultural differences that you wouldn't necessarily even pick up on had you not been,
right.
not been told about them mm-hmm. or seen them firsthand.
So then you're mostly working with the Afghan National Police. You're not actually training, right?
Yes, no, yeah. I wasn't in it. Was called an omelet or a pomelet, so an omelet
right.
training the Afghan National Army. Indirectly, you know, there would be training on how to do something on our camp, or how we as a company do something specifically, but we weren't there as developers. At this
yeah.
point, they were already trained and sent to us to,
okay. Okay.
to work with us.
Right. And what about interactions with, like, local people?
Dealing with the humanitarian aid groups is once again, a lot of it was indirectly to us. It'd be minimal on our end if we're there. But another good day is a good example of that. I guess would be on the camp every. I think it was once a month, every third week. If you were on security at the camp, you would also have to deal with. There's a day where individuals could bring in their children for medical attention. If you had a dispute or a claim against, like if there was a conflict. And some property was damaged, you can bring in your claim, as well as individuals looking for work in any of their infrastructure projects, as well, like development of roads, camp work, interpreters. I remember, I'll forever remember this. I remember doing the security one day, and a gentleman comes up. He's talking to me. I'm interested in obtaining some employment here on the camp, and he's talking just like this, using colloquialisms and nomenclature that is very common in Western culture. And so he's talking, he says, hey, I'm interested in becoming a general duties individual on the camp. And I'm like, well, you speak incredibly good English. Have you ever thought about becoming an interpreter? And he said, no, oh, I didn't really think about that. I'm like, well, the pay is nicer, and you know, there's other security issues with that as well that you have to be aware of. But so do you have, you know, if you have a resume and your Tascara is what they call their passports. He says, well, I don't have my Tascara, but I have my Canadian passport. The guy lived in Toronto for 3 years. He moved back with his family just before.
Oh, wow.
And so I'll always remember that. Lots of dealings with kids. When we went to we go to the prison a lot. Not so much after the outbreak, other than to do cleanup, but prior to that, we'd go and work on the infrastructure at the prison, right? How is hygiene being handled? How are the cells being handled and all this stuff? So we'd bring engineers over there. So prison itself is fairly secure, so our requirement for security was limited, so we have a bit more downtime while we're sitting at the prison. And how it works in prison is, if a male goes to prison, their family can come to the prison, or not, they're not imprisoned, but they're very much hanging at the prison, so there's a lot of kids that would just be at the prison, so it'd be kind of nice. You play the kids, give them a pan and a bottle of water.
So what was, like, everyday life in Camp Nathan's Smith that, like?
The most generic day would be get up, go do your evolutions, eat breakfast, go back, either go to the gym or go take some downtime in the room, go for a walk around the camp. The camp's very small, it was about 700 meters to run around the internal side of the external wall. So a very small camp for 300 people. And then meet over at the vehicle, start prepping the vehicle for the day, do our orders for whatever our movement was. If it was we'll go off the assumption that today's just going to be a day convoy or a 16-hour convoy out to one of the Afghan outposts that we're going to go work on or something like that. So do the fragos, mount up, weapons check, roll out of the camp. From there is, we dismount accordingly for drills. If you're crossing vulnerable points or vulnerable sections to check for device, explosive devices.
So what would that look like?
So your vehicle would dismount at a safe distance from, let's say, a cauldron. We're crossing over a water ditch with the cauldron. Dismount a safe distance away. Move yourselves into position. It's called a spider drill. Spread out of individuals that are in front of and surrounding the vehicle. You check under the vehicle and all sorts of stuff before carrying on, and then you move yourself forward looking for identifiers, turned up dirt, oil patches, flaggers, markers, suspicious individuals, wires, obviously, anything protruding from the dirt. Once that was deemed clear, or at least as clear as one can see superficially, then you would mount back up and proceed. And then, so carry on with convoy operations up to wherever we needed to dismount from. And then you would dismount, carry on. Typically, we wouldn't have to dismount too far from wherever our vehicles were. We'd check to keep our vehicles close. And then you'd set up a cordon of the area, secure the area, and however long it took.
Whatever. And just kind of station there for the day? So you said you would cycle into forward operating bases?
That's right. Like,
right? And then what would you be doing based out of there? Is that more foot patrols? Or?
Yes, yeah, that was more of a dismounted patrol through wherever area of operation. It was more presence patrols, so just making sure that the other side knows that we are very much here, and we are very much here for the long haul. So.
Right. And would you actually make contact very often, or is that more like just...
Indirectly. Most engagements would happen. 300 meters, 300 meters. It was nothing to this, like, so while dismounted, we would still have the ability to call on either air support or we would have our lab or our removal support close at hand. So any engagement that would happen would be a very short, rapid engagement followed by a guerrilla withdrawal. Couple of development ticks, nothing big while I was. Dismounted anyways. So. Mm-hmm.
Did you receive counterinsurgency training prior to leaving, or like instruction or anything like that?
Yes, yeah. It's, I can vaguely remember some of it, as I said. So, I I was 18, and it's been
right.
It's been 8 years now. But yes.
We okay. Did. Okay.
Yeah.
So how did, I guess you kind of talked about trying to keep an eye open for IEDs and how to try to prevent any incidences. How common was that, that you would have to kind of dismount, and how common were IEDs?
Because we were in a built up area, it was a lot more common practice, because there's more infrastructure, there's more chicanes, there's more cauldrons, there's more bottlenecks.
More possible, yeah.
So one of the ways to mitigate any potential threat was alternation of routes, both as a whole, and then also alternating your return routes. So we'd never move one way and then come back to the same route. We'd always stagger. And that mitigated to the best of its ability. IEDs were very common. That was the common practice in the city. We were unique, too. Our Camp Nathan Smith, anyways, and there was never attacked while I was there, because the Taliban are smart. They know that camp provided rehabilitation and humanitarian aid for the country, so to attack that is to attack the aid of the people, and they would not be doing themselves any favor to do so. So that camp itself was fairly secure. There was, I think the closest incident I remember was the night of the prison attack before switching off to QRF. We were stood two in the camp. We sighted in some mortars that were positioning themselves. They weren't going to attack the camp. We knew that. What they were doing is they were waiting for us to send out our quick reaction force so that they could mortar them. Because they wouldn't attack the camp. It wasn't a favorable move on their part.
Right. That makes sense. So could you describe some of the operations that spun out of the prison break?
Yes. So I guess for individuals who are hearing this and that don't know, the Sariposa prison break was a deliberate attack on the camp itself, starting with the suicide bomber to the rear of, or sorry, not the camp, the prison itself, starting with the suicide bomber to the prison, followed by a fuel truck breaching the main entrance, and surgeons coming in on both dismounted and mounted. They freed, please don't quote me on this, I can't remember, but it was close to 1,000 prisoners, 337, I believe, of which were Taliban insurgents. They then managed to, through the means of safe houses and bus transport and vehicle transport, shuttle them to the west. So then, because of that, there was a major push in the west, a three-day push. We were up for 47 hours ourselves, and it was mostly dismounted. Mostly dismounted foot patrols. It's been a while since I thought about this. I can't remember the exact location where we were. But we did a series of dismounted patrols. And then we'd just mount up again. It was about 47 hours. And I think there was a higher presence of... We brought in a large contingency of the Afghan National Army individuals. There was small pockets of insurgent fighting, followed by one medium engagement that lasted about 7 hours. I think it was 97 Taliban casualties, 3 Afghan army casualties. I think it was the final result. Mm-hmm.
So was the goal to actually recapture those prisoners, or mostly just to...
No, the goal is typically in incidents like this. It's a morale boost, right? So any organization or any combatant group is going to use the fallout of victory to kind of keep the momentum going. That's standard practice. You push and push and push and push and push, especially when you have the wind back in your sails. So that was a counter. We knew that something was coming. So to push back.
So, if I understood it correctly, you get 2 weeks off at some point in your deployment, is that right?
Yes, HLTA. I can't remember what the acronym stands for. I know the L is probably leave. we get 23 days once we are... for every 4 months, you're entitled to an HLTA. You get 23 days once you're in wherever you're transported to. So you'd have to, so for myself, I think it was at Nathan Smith. It may have been in the fall, but I'm pretty sure it was at Nathan Smith. It would have been, because they knew that they would have, that's where we comboed back to the camp, because they knew they brought everyone who was going on HLT back. At the time there was a, I think it was a German, or was it Dutch? Anyways, there's another NATO country, Chinook, that man who's going back to Canterbury Airfield. So I got airlifted from Nathan Smith to Canterbury Airfield. Spent a day in Canterbury Airfield. Got some Tim Hortons, that seems. Got to go to the Dutch PX. We didn't get much time. Like, we would go back for supply runs, but it was, someone grabbed the next episode of this on a USB stick and load up on that. That's about it. So got a day there, and then we traveled out for a couple days, and then I went to Europe. My senior business friends that were exchange students in town, which is nice.
So did that make the deployment easier, or did it really have an effect?
Yeah, it was nice. My brother and my best friend met me in Europe, so that was nice. You have the option of going home. I don't think I would have gone home if I was given the opportunity to change it. I think that would have been more difficult. It was nice. I got to be around the right type of people. The people I trust and don't have to explain myself to, but at the same time, you feel close to them. Mm-hmm. It was a good balance.
So when you're providing security, are you usually working, like, is it usually a platoon that you're, like, what's the unit that you're
actually? So the force protection is a company, which consists of approximately 200 individuals. Out of that, there was three rifle companies and then a support company. Three rifle platoons and a support platoon. And then four sections in each one of those platoons. I was one VP, so one Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, Bravo Company, four platoon, three section.
Right.
And I was fire team. So.
And so, would you move with your platoon or with your section or company?
Later? Yes. So the lowest level that you would move at would be section level. And even then, on convoy ops, the standard practice was no less than three. So you would need three sections worth. It wouldn't necessarily be your sections. Now you have to take into account things, anything from casualties to HLTA to medical to compassionate to reassignment to disciplinary. People are taken out of your section or out of your platoon or out of your company, so those holes need to be filled. Every vehicle should be full. So if your vehicle has an empty seat in it, you're wrong. That's one less person to make you combat ineffective if something arises. So you'd often swap out.
Okay.
That was the reality. Preferred not to, but you'd be swapping, especially mid tour, beginning of tour and end tour, so all of it. But really at those three, kind of lulled and then pick back up and then lull and pick back up because these people are clearing in, so you only have portions of people when you're was when the majority of the HLTA occurred, so people were leaving to go to all sorts of places around the world for their leave. And so you'd have to fill in those gaps, and then we'd kind of rest out a bit, and then when everyone was clearing out and the RCR were clearing in, you'd have to fill the gaps.
So did that have did that affect day-to-day, other than just swapping people in, did that inhibit operations or
We were lucky. We had fairly buffed up sections. We had almost two extra guys per section, and in my platoon anyways, so that helped out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Workup training really helped too, right? There's the difference between going to, if me and you were told that we have to go complete a small task, and then if me and you worked together for 10 months prior to even having to execute any of those tasks, your life's going to be easier. So that really did help. Some argue that, workup training is longer than it needs to be, and other people argue that any time that you're together, you can just pick up on each other's abilities and personal strengths and weaknesses is only going to benefit the task. So.
Mm-hmm. So you've answered a lot of my questions, but I feel like I'm still getting very general general answers, and that's okay, but I'm trying to figure out ways to ask more specific things without trying to direct you at all.
Let's say ask away, and if I don't feel comfortable, I won't.
Okay. Well, I think what I'm kind of looking for is more specific memories, if you can.
Okay. I'm trying to think. I got a lot.
In terms to specific.
Little things. Trying to think. I remember my first day on the job. As I said, you usually start by being oriented in a tower. I remember going up and it was Tower 3, so that would have been side of the camp. That would have been on the northeast side of the camp. And there's this open field, and then there's a two little compounds, kind of little tiny farmland, not very big, but a house and then a mud sort of wall around it, and another one. And then there was a little gate underneath our tower, and a little path with a water, a water ditch underneath it. I remember behind those farms, it's just a big open field. So I get up to the tower someone was showing me, and they're going, here's the C6 on the FSK, here's your log, here's your arcs, show me the surroundings, here's the radio, the orientation. If you need anything, just call on the radio. So, it must have been 10 minutes I'm up there, and so the operating thing was in the day, you didn't need to have more than, you could have one person in a tower, it wasn't a requirement to have two. All of a sudden, boom, this big explosion on the other side of these things, and I remember I'm getting down, I have my weapon up, and I'm sighting in, I'm looking for flags or vantage points for whoever was triggering whatever had just gone off, and so I jump on the radio, and I'm like, security, this is Tower 3, I just had an explosion 1,200 meters out, directly to my front. Oh yeah, we forgot to tell you that the EOD team blows up all the ordnance that they collect through the week on Mondays at noon. It's welcome to the country. It was good. Past that, there's a lot of little things like that. It was a really good group of people. So I was a reservist, as I said. And how it worked in the past, and in the future, I guess, as well, because we were one-off. To my knowledge, I don't know anyone else, we were an entire platoon of reservists. So often, when augmented, you would fill in, two guys would go into a regular force section here, and two guys would go into there, and there, and there. And that's what went, but we were 40 reservists placed into a company. So we were led by reservists, worked alongside reservists, and it was sort of an entire self-sufficient platoon of reservists. So that was really cool. I have friends. It also helped a lot coming home. You can understand the importance of camaraderie in a situation like that. So how reserves work is after being redeployed to their lodging base, after 2 days they return to their home unit. So for myself, who would have been in active British Columbia, if I was embedded in this as most reservists were, I would have one person to talk to, and he may have been from Calgary, he may have been from God knows where. I was very lucky. I had several members from my unit because of just the amount of reservists around. So you had a community to talk to that's closer. The regular force understands that importance, and they often keep you together afterwards. And so for us, it was a bit of a drive. Mine was 4 or 5 hours away to talk to somebody else that was in my section, but at least I had that. I couldn't imagine not being able to connect. And we're very lucky. We live in a very media savvy world, mm-hmm. which really, really helps. Mm-hmm. Other little things. So as I said, I was rather young. I'm the second youngest Canadian soldier to deploy to Afghanistan, to my knowledge. The only other person I met is Cowlink North. He was a Calgary Highlander. He's now in the regular force. He was in my section as well. Awesome guy. I remember when we were both on the ground, what were we doing? I think we were heading back to Kandahar. This must have been one of my third or fourth patrol. Had a trailer on the back of our RG, and we were moving called Pac-4 Charlie's in a variety of things. So Pac-4 is like, it's a little attachment that goes on your rifle that helps you with an infrared laser so that you can either do target acquisition for other individuals or improve your accuracy and efficiency of fire at night. So they're about a bit bigger than a smartphone or anything along those size, you know, a couple 6 inches by 4 inches, not very big at all. But we had them in a container, and then we had a bunch of other stuff in this trailer, and this sort of meshed covering for it. And it was cinched down, but I guess it wasn't cinched down all the way. And so we're going down this goat trail, and the cover comes off, and things are bouncing, and these are controlled items. So we're watching these things, and just like, this is our first task of the day, and we're already screwed it up. So you can see out of the back of the Nino, and then this kid jumps up on the back of the vehicle because we're stopped at a water chicane and tries to get into the boxes. And it's a 400-pound blaster on this thing. It's rather slow to give up. And we get it open, and Cal jumps out and manages to scoop this kid off the trailer. But I remember the kid wasn't phased at all. Little things. More serious stories. I guess my first incident would have been, well, outside of the suicide bombing at the dogfight there. I'm not going to discuss that, though. I remember the first time seeing an IED go off. So at the dogfight, we responded to an IED. We didn't actually see it go off. The first time seeing when there was an American convoy that was just outside of Camp Nathan Smith that was coming in. And I was on the front gate guard at the time. I had a C9 for some reason, too. I can't remember why. I think it was someone from Winter or something. But watching, so this IED went off. It wasn't a big one. It was minor injuries. But watching, because it was so close to the camp, they could just walk back. Mm-hmm. So it's zombified, like they couldn't hear. You could just see the how concussed and how messed up they were. It was surreal, and all you could do was just, the medics got out there at obviously the gate, but it was very interesting. That was kind of the dog fight is where it hit me, where I realized where I really was, the surroundings. But every life matters, for sure. Absolutely every life matters. But that was seeing somebody else that was also a NATO combatant. It's kind of really thinking about that could be you. As I said, it's funny. I haven't really thought of much in the last couple of years. It's been a long time. Anything? Is there anything else kind of specific what you're thinking of?
Yeah, I can try. Just like a few things.
Sure.
It's probably stuff I've already asked you, but if there's like anything more specific that you can talk about. Although I guess I didn't really ask this, but I'm assuming you received like first aid training, is that
yes.
right? And so what kind of training specifically would that have?
So combat casualty care is the step above everyone receives that, but then I also was able to do my TCCC, which is kind of it is to assist the medics, so we have company medics. So one of the medics actually was a reservist, Dave Irway, here from Victoria now in Halifax. He was attached to our unit prior to a very, very awesome man. And so we assist the medics with additional stuff. So you learn outside the basic three, which was tourniquet, quick clot, and Israeli bandage. We learn more advanced levels to assist. So IV, intravenous needle, how to deal with splinter and blast wounds, in particular open wounds, sudden chest wounds. So, big thing was blasts and bullets. Was sustainable first aid.
And what does that mean?
So we have roles. There's a Role 3 hospital at Kandahar Airfield, as well as the hospital within our camp. So our job is not to fix the individual, it's to sustain them, to get them back as quickly as possible. That now that depended very much on the type of wound, mobility of the force that's reacting to it, whether if you have an ID that struck a vehicle, now that vehicle's immobile. If you're in a three-vehicle packet, you're not leaving the area, so now you need air mobile support through a nine-liner evac. Are those assets available? Is the area green? How close are you to the proximity of a hospital or a Role 3 so that you can actually get the individual at first aid? Are they what level? Injured. So there's a variety of issues. And so our job is to assist with the medic with triage as well. So if there was an incident, obviously, with an IED, there's going to be a whole spectrum of injury, if anything, from a boot to vital signs absent the moment you respond to the incident. And so the head medic's job is to triage appropriately. He's going to deal with what he needs as a priority, and that gives his teachers years to work on what they are trained to do, which is typically medium level to lower level incidents, or at least sustain them until the medic can come by. The difference between putting pressure on a blast wound is the difference of 20 minutes or 30 minutes away for an individual, and if that medic can do something to prolong that until the or if we can do that to prolong it, until the medic can prolong it, or if he can do it until the nine liner can prolong it, and then he can get up to the doctor, very, very well, maybe it will save lives.
Right. So, what about, I don't know, let's go back to like civilian, like the actual development projects. So I know you weren't really involved in the projects themselves, but what kind of projects would you have been around?
So the biggest, most notable one would have been Operation Electric Avenue, which is my favorite name for any operation we did by far. And that was the movement of a generator for the dam in southern Afghanistan. So that was less dealing with civilian agencies and more of the logistics behind moving a very large piece of equipment from one end of the province to the other. We had a lot of aid from other countries on that, particularly in the road clearance side of the house. So the problem with moving a unique and large object is it limits your routes that you can take. If looking at it from a strategic advantage, if an opponent can strike something like that and stop something that's going to raise a lot of morale from a NATO standpoint, NATO bringing in infrastructure that's helping reconstruct the province, is a huge win. So that was something that was, if it could be targeted, not only would directly show a force and strength for the Taliban, but it's also something that could very easily be done because of the limited number of routes that we could take. So because of that, there was a lot of focus on clearance of routes. So it was very slow and methodical movements that lasted. I can't even remember how long. It was a long trip. So things like that. Road infrastructure was big too. School infrastructure, anything from, you name it. Like, no task too small. Like, we're talking, I remember sitting out for 8 hours doing a cordon so that we could build, engineers could build clotheslines for the Afghan National Army to hang their uniforms after they'd be cleaned. So it's no project too small. They wanted it and they needed help with it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, how, like, would you actually get downtime when you were there, or what did that look like?
Yeah, so I just said we would rotate. Well, not so much. There was downtime, but it was different. We were very lucky. Camp Nathan Smith is the camp sergeant major at the time was a very interesting man. I will never say anything ill against him. But he wanted, it was his pet project was that camp. And one of the advantages to come out of it was, there was a lot of ergonomical use of space for relaxing, we'll say. There was a gym, and we're talking a very small camp, as I said previously. There was a gym, there was a full-size hockey rink. There was an area to eat outside and a cool down area. There was another couple pieces of mod tent set up with sort of a lounge, as well as a emergency fire reservoir, which was converted into an area if you really wanted to go for a swim. You could dip yourself in the water, which was nice. So downtime came. A force that's typically responding to something allows for the potential for more downtime, but also responding to something means that you're not, things can go, mice and men, things have to go right. But because of that, and because this is how the system worked for cycling sections through things, it allowed basically for a week of patrolling. A day or maybe a day and a half off. And so when I say off, you're not assigned anything. You're still, we need somebody over here. They're sending, Caesar's going out to go check the, sorry, Caesar was our bomb dog. They're sending Caesar out to go check these vehicles. We need somebody to go with them. Johnson's sick. Can you fill him for 3 sections? Stuff like that. So you're always, work before play. But in between, basically each week, there was a day or two of downtime. So, patrol for a week, FOB for a week, 2 weeks, defense of the camp for a week, and then defensive defense and training for the Afghan, or sorry, the Blue Hat at the palace. And so that's kind of how we would, rotate within our sections.
Mm-hmm.
And then so in between there, there may be a day or two. And then defense and security of the camp is really where your downtime is. It's like you do an 8-hour shift that day, and that's it.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm. So, what about like decision making on the ground? Like, how much authority do? I guess that's not really your position, but you would have witnessed it, like on the ground. Who?
That actually is very implied about that question. So. They had a saying, everyone's a censor, and or the strategic corporal. I was promoted to corporal over there at the time, so I was private, and I was promoted to corporal. And so, with technology, we had PRs. Everyone had a radio, so you could all talk. And this was a closed net, so the talk back at Camp Nathan Smith or Canada Airfields in here, and this is just a closed net between the section or the platoon. So being able to talk is huge. You know, this guy looks suspicious. Can you shift left? Can you do this? Oh, I think I see something over there. And so because you're a sensor and your set of eyes, it's not only helps directly with whatever's going on, but after a while, you are also profiling in the sense of, I've seen this vehicle 3 times, and every time we see this vehicle, something bad happens. I'm just using vague examples here, but a good one is for that incident, actually, that incident that occurred, I think it ended in one of the guard, or someone in the tower taking a, or at least exchanging fire with a guy in that, and somebody, when they went back to the logbooks, they actually noticed, like, somebody reported that they've seen somebody up on this specific building. It was something like 3 times in the book or something like that. So that's where you as an individual, not necessarily making command decisions, but are a sensor and have the ability to really impact whatever's going on, because you can collect and gather this information and push it up. And because the Army's realized how important that is, they promote that, and that's where we have our intel gatherers, and all of this gets compiled into a report every time you Patrol report is compiled, and that report goes back, and then those are consolidated, and they start to look for patterns, and that's how they can develop. They start to see, we're seeing an increase in pressure plate IEDs. Well, that means we need to start changing our tactics to deal with victim-operated IEDs. So we need to start altering this the way that we do this, and then because then the Taliban will do the same. We'll start seeing how that, we're stopping farther away, or we're doing this, or we're recognizing that they're daisy chaining IEDs, and then they will collect their information that, what we need to do is we need to add another daisy chain, or we need to change this, and then theirs will shift, and it's slipping back and forth. And that's where it's not so much command decision, but making sure that what you are gathering through your senses is being pushed up,
right,
to the people that will be making those decisions. And because of that too, because of the way that warfare has changed and the tempo of it, yes, I may be the private on the ground, but if I see something that it's like people will listen to me.
Right.
It's less of like, I'm in charge here, everybody listen to me. There's time and a need for that. It is very important. But with the tempo of operation, you need to be flexible and adapt to what's going on. And in order to do that, you need to utilize every individual involved. So.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful, yeah. What about larger operations? Are you a part of any larger operations? I'm thinking in particular Operation Timis Prime. I'm not sure.
Timis Prime, yeah.
Prime?
Optimus Prime. It's Optimus Prime.
Yeah. I had an interview with Dan McKenzie yesterday.
Okay.
And I think I accidentally said Optimus Prime, and he finally got that was the joke. He hadn't realized
that
before.
Oh, yeah. yes. I will be completely honest with you. I was part of the operation. I can't even remember, like, as I said, there's a certain point in the day when you wake up and you're just like, all right, orders.
Right.
Okay, let's do it. Like, I'm in charge of this rifle and this, or, like, mm-hmm. arc, so it's, I couldn't even tell you what I did.
That's okay. That's okay.
But yes, I was.
Okay.
Yeah, it's surreal now thinking about it. And like I remember, you know, as I said, I was an 18-year-old kid. Everything was you know, at the time everything was important in heightened senses and stuff like that. And now you look back and you go, I would have never thought I would be comfortable in a situation and just wake up and go, all right, let's go through the day. What's going on, right? Like just like if you're waking up. Here and going to work.
Right.
So that's the funny thing about it all is there is a part of it that's, you know, it is easy. It's a tough job, but it's once you have your head in that headspace and timing and that right. Tuned in, it's easy to just. This is what I'm doing today. It
becomes normal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So by the end, were you ready to head home?
Yeah. Yeah, I was. It was interesting. So we had a decompression in Cyprus mm-hmm. for a week. That was fun. It was nice. So I haven't actually drank in 3 years, 3 years sober, but at the time I did. So a lot of people were released. It's a smart way of, you know, transitioning.
Right.
Have your fun in a controlled environment, blow off that steam, and then actually go home. I was 19. I had my 19th birthday overseas. I was ready. Yeah, I don't want to say I was itching to go home, but I don't want to say it was just kind of like it was that right level of like, yeah, I can go home now.
Right.
So
that's good. I think this is kind of winding it back a little bit, but in a lot of my reading, they talk about how with the 6-month deployments, there's a lot of issues kind of reestablishing relationships with. The local people and like the Afghan National Army and those kind of relationships that are really important to trying to fight a counterinsurgency. And
yes, and that's where it gets what's talking cultural differences, as I said.
Right.
The Afghan people it's just a slower progress, and that's because they want to get to know you before you even start talking business. It's who are you? Who's mm-hmm. your family? Who's your mother? Who's your daughter? Who's your son? Where do you live? Was, you know, tell me about your history of your family. Your family moved to Canada. Like they could talk. You could talk for days and days mm-hmm. and go back to where like your great 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 grandfather. Yeah, and they honestly want to know. And there's a lot of merit in that. I think that's really, really cool. I think, you know, we're a very hustle and bustle kind of society, and we could really draw a lot from that. Mm-hmm. And so yes, because of that, and you know. Conflicts like this are about bullets and taking down the bad guy. It's about, you know, the goal is to help a country, reconstruct a country, or not necessarily reconstruct, but provide assistance to reconstruct. And you also have to do that and let them do it. And in order to do that, you have to gain trust, and through that trust, education. And then there's the convoluted topics of, you know, what's guidance and what's Western influence and what's assimilation and what's a country just asking for help. And so that, you know, that's all a very slow process. And so any conflict like this is not going to be won through you know, how many dollars you throw at a project or how many of this is how long can you work with that generation and the generation to follow, and that's ultimately it is a long process, and so the six-month turnaround is complete step back, but you know, mm-hmm. you have to rebuild that trust, and that's and that is the thing with Afghan culture, particularly, is trust is huge. It's a more of a tribalistic style of society, and so who you work with is very. You need to trust them. Very, very important before you start doing anything. And so every time, you know, every 6 months, every 8 months, if you're working with someone new, you got to build that trust in them. Mm-hmm. And then you also have to look at the, you know, the psychological effects on the soldiers as well too. You can look at the Americans in 12-month tours.
Right, that's
that,
true.
How that burnout has an effect on mm-hmm. coalition forces as well. Mm-hmm. I remember we had 12 Americans on our camp. Four of them just spent 12 months in Iraq, got 2 weeks off, in Kuwait, and were carrying on an 8-month mission in Afghanistan.
No, I can't imagine.
So there's burnout there, right? And with that burnout, not only is there psychological effects afterwards, but in-house too. Out of those 12, 7 of them were killed on the tour because of situations that they removed themselves from a kill zone, they were attacked, and they decided that they would go back. So, is that necessarily the right move to do? Who knows? I wasn't involved in that incident, but maybe things would have been different had they had a little bit of time to decompress before carrying on with their operation.
Right. So, what was it like actually coming home and trying to adjust?
It was interesting. I was very lucky. I have a wonderful support group in my family. My family is nothing but patient. So the first thing is reintegrating, right? So you've gone from not only working with a select group of people, but in a very different culture, in a very different environment, everything's different. So sensory overload happens, and typically what happens to sensory overload is shut down, right? You just shut down here. Emotionally inept is probably the best way of putting it. So you don't. It's a survival mechanism. So I became a bit more absorbed and not really express. Watch what's going on, see what's going on, comment, judge, or just absorb and take it in, react appropriately when something needs to be reacted to. So that, you know, that took a while. It took a very long time to open up from that. Took a bit of time off as a reserves camp. And then came back to it after my leave. And the biggest advantage I felt for me for helping was a challenge again, which was nice. So I started teaching. I took my leadership courses and started instructing. That really helped me. I found my passion for going from 60 to 0, going from an operation back to the reserves can be a bit of a it's a slower paced thing. You know, you went from resources and equipment and assets and a tempo and a level and standard that's not necessarily achievable through routine training than the reserves. And so becoming an instructor was probably the first major reintegration for me from the military aspect. It provided me not only a challenge, but it provided me input into the organization. I got to develop the tools using the training plans and developing myself through teaching techniques and understanding these training plans and implementing them into new courses or something like that. It was wonderful. I was also one of the first guys from Nanaimo to deploy, so helping with the future deployments as well, working with the families in the future deployments as well. So also gave you something that you know, there's bumps. There's always bumps. It's long for a reaction. There's not the same reaction. There's you were going to react. One of the biggest pieces of advice that I was given, these words that stick with me, is you're not acting abnormal, or you're not acting abnormal to a normal situation. You're acting normal to an abnormal situation.
Right.
That kind of resonated. So,
yeah.
You know, things would happen. People, you'd have little things that would come up here.
Right. So were you able to, like, in your teaching, were you actually using your experiences from Afghanistan to...
To a degree. We have something called ISPAC, which is a variety of teaching techniques, and one of them is examples. So you need experience from a variety of things. So yeah, I love weapons lectures. Weapons lectures are probably one of my favorite subjects to teach. There's a perfect combination of knowledge and physical application. And being able to really emphasize the importance of cleaning the weapon system, or proper sight of the weapon system, using your means of indication on how to direct your section mates in the use of that weapon system so that they can effectively engage a target, as well as all relatable. And you can draw from experience. It's the difference between, okay, someone's telling me this, and okay, I can actually see the physical application of this experience and why it's important for me to know this.
So what have you kind of taken away from your deployments, like kind of final conclusions about your time spent there?
Would I deploy again with the armed forces? Absolutely. Do I feel that in the time that I was there that progress was made? Absolutely. Would... I'm in a unique situation. I am now a veteran. I'm a very young veteran. That's changed dramatically over the last years for a lot of people in Canada. And I feel that it's our responsibility to engage the people and explain. You know, there's a lot of things that you can discuss, not only from an experience standpoint, but just from, as I said, things like people don't understand. When we are overseas, yes, there is a battle group. Their job is offensive operations. They are to engage the enemy and to look for them and see them. It's one part. It's not conventional warfare. It's not what you see as, you know, in the movies of Vietnam or World War II. We have a goal, and unfortunately, that goal does involve conflict. But things such as, you know, the people's take on what peacekeeping is and what peacekeeping means to Canada, importance to Canada, is absolutely vital. You know, I'm very proud that we have a peacekeeping nation, but what the implications of those words are on the individuals on the ground are huge. It's the difference between rules and engagement. Can I defend myself or individuals around me? It's very different as a peacekeeper than it is as a combatant. And so I think it's our responsibility as individuals that have been a part of these more recent conflicts to really get out there in the community and explain the importance of, you know, why the Afghan mission is important and had it carried on, where that necessarily would have seen the impact for generations to come. And because, you know, the Afghan war is over, and the Afghan conflict is over, but they're inevitably, and the unfortunate reality will be something else, and how we approach that, and the lessons that we learn from there, not only for us as soldiers to implement, but also so that the people understand why decisions are made and why we go a certain route, and the importance of the impact of a withdrawal or a change in policy or a change in operation, and how that's going to directly impact the effect that we're having in whatever conflict or country or operation that we're in. Mm-hmm. So I know that's a long-winded answer, but what I took out of it is you know, my experience is that we had a positive impact. And I think it's important for that to be expressed to the people because I am, for lack of a better word, a tool of the people, and they need to understand what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think often there can be a disconnect between what's happening on the ground and what's being told to the general population or how they perceive it. They hear about one instance and all of a sudden an entire...
And that's not an isolated incident to the armed forces. That's a variety. You have a big organization. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of internal workings and components, and people can only perceive so much of that. And it is the ownership of the organization to be transparent with them. Not only from a trust value, but from an educational value. I can't remember how many, you know, and I'm in a unique situation too as a reservist. That's a whole other side of the game that people come up to me, oh, you've been overseas as a reservist? Like, that happens? It's like, yes. Like, there are operations out there and there are opportunities if that's something that you want to pursue as a reservist. And the benefits of being a reservist and being a well-rounded individual in the sense of civilian and military life has its merits, and how that, you know, a good example is I talk, you know, people ask me, why do you belong to a gym, right? Why do you pay the extra money to go to a gym here? And it's like, I've had some of the most interesting conversations with civilians because of that. And I choose to be a part of the community. Outside, I don't want to isolate myself or institutionalize myself. This is one example of it. Mm-hmm. So I think connecting.
Well, I think you've answered all my questions. Is there anything else you'd like to bring up or talk about?
I really honestly didn't even give much thought to
the
last little while anyways. It's been a long time. It's actually kind of enlightened how it's like, oh, it's like all these things that really were, like, you know, eidetic memories of faded a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting to think that can occur.
Yeah. Everyone, other people in my class are generally doing World War II events, so they've got a lot of time in between there. But it's interesting how memory works.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Master Corporal Jaden Cormier on March 8th, 2016. So now I'll get you to sign the interview release form.
What's the date today? It's the 8th.
Okay, so we have both signed the interview release form, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.